From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, new data quantifies the concentrated disadvantages of one Milwaukee neighborhood.
Then a new study looks at the disparity between home and workplace segregation in U.S. cities.
There's not a single city in the country where residential segregation or nighttime segregation was lower than workplace or daytime segregation.
Later, cellist and contributor Robert Cohen talks about the challenges he'll face as a conductor.
You have to have a really good plan about how you would like it to go, because otherwise you've got all these members of the orchestras feeling different things from the music and somebody at the front not really leading them through a specific path.
And an Arctic explorer gives his advice for dealing with the frigid weather.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The economic and other disparities between residents of Milwaukee's central city and other parts of the metro area are well known. The suburbs in particular show lower rates of poverty and incarceration and higher income, education, and home ownership than many parts of the central city. That's especially true for one zip code.
For many, 53206 has become a metaphor for the challenges facing inner city residents, especially people of color. The area's high incarceration rate and low employment rate have attracted national and even international reporting. A study just out tries to quantify what it terms the ecosystem of disadvantage in 53206. Its author is Mark Levine, a professor emeritus of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee, and he is with us in the studio to share what he and his team learned. Welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure, Mitch. Thanks.
The title of this report references concentrated disadvantage, but you also use a couple of terms within the report that I wanted to ask you about just to kind of get us talking. There's the term cumulative disadvantage and ecosystem of disadvantage. I guess talk about what you're getting at with each of those terms.
Yeah, lots of jargon in there. And they generally, I think, all point to the same phenomenon, but they sort of emphasize different aspects of it. I mean, when we talk about concentrated disadvantage, we're talking about a number of disadvantages that obviously we talk about in the study,
right,
in terms of earnings inequality, income inequality, poverty, unemployment, you know the drill, all sort of concentrated in a geographic space, spatial kind of disadvantage. When we talk about cumulative disadvantage, that also refers to that concentration, but it refers to sort of an accumulation of those disadvantages, both interacting with one another and over time. And later on in the study, when we talk about an ecosystem, that more or less references the same kind of phenomenon of interlocking or interconnected kinds of disadvantages that form a kind of an ecosystem, for lack of a better term, that characterizes the entire kind of socioeconomic phenomenon that are occurring in the neighborhood.
The idea you can't isolate poverty from education and education from, say, housing or employment or whatever.
Right. All of the factors sort of contribute to one another and they create this concentration of disadvantage. And when we talk about the ecosystem, particularly in the report when we discussed, for example, what the potential impact of improving education can be in various neighborhoods, we talk about the degree to which you have to look at that factor in the context of all of the other factors of what we're calling the ecosystem. So the ecosystem of the potential for somebody to get a job in a place like Waukesha County versus 53206 tend to be very different no matter what the education levels of individuals would be.
Well, and so anyone who has followed the coverage of the challenges Milwaukee faces is probably familiar with the dire straits that 53206 in particular is in. But there were some surprises, even in a positive sense, that employment numbers were actually up.
I think the good news in the study is that since the depths of the Great Recession, things have improved in 53206 in a number of areas. As you referenced, the employment rate has gone up. The poverty rate has come down. Poverty rate for children has also come down. So there are a few areas where we can say the trend line has improved. that has to be put, obviously, in the context, and the context being that the depths of the Great Recession are the absolute worst. Coming up from there has not even, in most of those areas, brought 53206 back to where it was even in the year 2000, let alone when we get back into the 20th century. So the sort of the good news and the bad news is things have improved a little bit. The recovery has been trickling down. I'm absolutely certain that the work of many of the good organizations that are working hard on the ground in 53206 are having an impact, and that's certainly helping things. But the bottom line is the longer-term structural problems facing 53206 are still very real, and they are still creating conditions of the most dire kinds of poverty and joblessness.
And certainly the rate of improvement in 53206 in comparison to the rate of improvement elsewhere is significantly lower.
Yeah, the rate of improvement generally is slower, although the employment rate certainly has climbed percentage-wise, probably a little bit faster than the rest of the metropolitan area, but that's because the rate, the base, was so much lower to begin with. I mean, at the depths of the Great Recession, only 36% of all of the working-age adults between the ages of 20 and 64 in 53206 were employed. So that jumped to 47%, so that's about a, 35% increase. So that's pretty impressive. That's certainly better than lots of other areas, but it still means that fewer than half of the working age adults are employed, and that applies also to what we call the prime age working age adults between 25 and 54. When generally in a reasonably healthy labor market, you expect a very high percentage. In the suburbs, for example, in the 25 to 54. Cohort, 90% are employed. In 53206, it's 49%.
There are also a number of other discouraging signs in terms of employment, especially as educational attainment and employment intersect. How do those intersections compare with the other parts of the city and the metro area?
One of the most, I think, striking findings of the study is the degree to which education affects outcomes in various areas. We looked at employment, we looked at earnings of workers, we looked at household income, and we looked at poverty rates and looked at how education affected those. And one of the findings, which is of course not in the least bit surprising, was that education matters, so that the high school dropout in 53206 is less likely to be employed than a college graduate living in 53206. A high school dropout in 53206 is likely to have lower household income than a college graduate or someone with some college or an associate's degree. So, as you move up the educational attainment ladder, economic outcomes improve. What we were, I think, particularly surprised to find was the degree to which, however, there were disparities when we controlled for education. So when we compared the outcomes for college graduates living in 53206 versus a college graduate living, say, in Waukesha County, or a high school dropout in one jurisdiction versus high school dropout in another. So when we control for education, you find that, for example, the employment rate for a high school dropout in Waukesha County is almost three times the rate of a high school dropout in 53206. And those disparities work as we go up and down the educational attainment ladder. But more strikingly, we saw disparities between, say, the employment rate or the poverty rate or the earnings of a high school dropout in a place like Waukesha County versus a college graduate or someone with just some college or an associate's degree, which is still, a higher form of education, living in 53206. The poverty rate for a high school dropout in Waukesha County is about the same as for a college graduate living in 53206. The earnings of a high school dropout living in Waukesha County are about the same as a college graduate living in 53206. Employment rate in the Milwaukee suburbs as a whole for high school dropouts is about the same as for someone with some college in their educational attainment in 53206. So education matters. But back to that earlier point when you asked about the ecosystem, there's an ecosystem of disadvantage. Is it where jobs are? Is it because there's racial discrimination? Is it because of the cumulative disadvantages, less health care available, that there's certainly more disability in employment disability in 53206? All of those factors may affect the degree to which education can improve outcomes, but it's still nonetheless extraordinarily striking to see the disparity, for example, between the economic outcomes of a high school dropout or just a high school graduate in a place like Waukesha County or the Milwaukee suburbs generally, and more educated individuals living in 53206.
And so with this in mind, it should probably not surprise anyone to find that, in general, the poverty rate in 53206 circa 2017 far exceeds the rest of the area.
It's about seven times, I believe, the rate, or six times the rate of the metropolitan area as a whole and the suburban areas. The poverty rate in 53206 is 42%. Again, you know, it's an improvement from the depths of the Great Recession when it was 47%, although statistically, because there's an error margin there, it's unclear that there's a huge difference there. But let's say it's declined a little bit. But it's still much, much higher than the city as a whole. It's much, much higher, obviously, than the suburbs. Again, the children's poverty rate, which reached a shocking, and that's the only word for it, 66%. Two-thirds of the children living in 53206 live below the poverty line at the depths of the Great Recession. That's come down to about 55%, but we're still talking about off-the-chart poverty rates.
Well, and along those lines, you studied something called intergenerational economic mobility. What does that concept mean, and how were you able to study that?
Intergenerational economic mobility refers to the degree to which you're able to do better than your parents did. So how did the children growing up in poor households in 53206 or throughout the rest of the metropolitan area do as they reached adulthood? Did they move to a higher economic bracket? Were their incomes higher than their parents? Or were they in a better, technically we call it the percentile of the income distribution? So if they were born and raised in a family in the 25th percentile, which would be the low end of the income distribution, when they reached young adulthood, what percentile did they reach? We got access to very generously shared a database from the Harvard-based Equality of Opportunity Project, which has an extraordinary big database of Internal Revenue Service data that they've linked with Census Bureau data that they were able to get. All the individuals in it are de-identified, so there's no confidentiality breach at all. But from that data, you're able to track how children who grew up in various areas in the late 1970s and the early 1980s fared as adults in the middle part of the 2010s. So I think the income data that we have is for 2014, 2015. And so these are children who were born between 1978 and 83, and we're seeing what their condition is in 2014 and 2015. We found for black males growing up in 53206, born again into the 25th percentile, low end of the income distribution in the late 70s or early 80s, that by the time they reached adulthood, young adulthood, in 2014, 2015, they were in the 25th percentile. They had not achieved any intergenerational mobility. For white males, however, again, starting off in the same economic situation, starting off in the 25th percentile, but growing up in different ecosystems, the ecosystem, for example, of Waukesha County, which has more manufacturing job growth, which created greater opportunities certainly in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s.
Right, not the same kind of deindustrialization.
Precisely. You know, I mean, later on there is deindustrialization, yep. But the early movement of manufacturing jobs in Milwaukee was in fact from the central city to places like Waukesha, to New Berlin, and that sort of thing. So growing up there, some of the lower income and less educated youth in places like Waukesha County could achieve some mobility, so that those white males growing up in the Milwaukee suburbs, and Waukesha in particular, had risen from the 25th percentile to the 45th percentile. For females, there was a little more mobility for African Americans, but generally much, much less than, again, for whites. You know, what this tells us is clearly there are racial disparities in terms of economic mobility, the ability to climb the economic ladder. It also tells us that white poverty and black poverty are different. That growing up in concentrated poverty neighborhoods, which is where a large number of the African American poor grow up, is very different than growing up, even if you're poor, even if your household is poor, in an area where the schools are better, where there are more job opportunities, where there's less crime, and where poverty isn't as concentrated geographically in a neighborhood.
Finally, you look at incarceration rates and discover that this is still a significant issue in 53206, but apparently not quite to the level of hyperbole that's commonly used.
There's been a substantial amount of hyperbole about what is, in fact, a very, very serious problem. So let's start out by saying there's no gainsaying whatsoever the fact that mass incarceration is a major scourge afflicting 53206 and, in fact, the African-American community generally in Milwaukee. That said, for a variety of reasons, there's been a bit of, I think, exaggeration of the condition. There was documentary which referred to 53206 as the most incarcerated zip code in America. So we wanted to see if there was any data that would give us some insight in that. And one of the things we found out is how difficult it is to get really accurate, complete, usable data on incarceration for just Wisconsin and Milwaukee and for neighborhoods like 53206, let alone across the country. Again, we found a couple of interesting databases, one of which was, again, the Harvard Equality of Opportunity Project. Another one was data that the Brookings Institution has collected, which, again, looks at how children growing up in the late 70s and early 80s were faring in terms of whether they were incarcerated by 2010, 2012, 2014. The Brookings Project had data on zip codes. So we looked at that, and 53206 was not anywhere near the top. If you want to know the most incarcerated zip code in America, it's Nashville 37228, where almost 30% of males growing up in that zip code in the 70s and early 80s by 2010 ended up in prison, which is an extraordinary rate. The other database, again, was the Harvard base, which let us look at census tracts. And we looked at all of the census tracts within 53206 to see, again, what the incarceration rate was of children who grew up in 53206 in the late 70s and early 80s. And we found it ranged from about a low of 10% in some census tracts to about 35% in the worst. Again, a terrible incarceration rate. Clearly, we have a major problem. But we found that about 3,500 other census tracts in the country that had higher incarceration rates. So by this measure, and this is just one way of measuring it, you know, we can say that the incarceration rate in 53206 is terrible, but it's not certainly the worst in the United States. What we also did was collect data to just get a snapshot of today and say, you know, what is the percentage of black males at various ages in 53206 who are either incarcerated or under the supervision of the State Department of Corrections. It's a very complicated issue to get the third category, which is ex-offenders who are off paper or are not showing because they're off paper, so we don't have, you know, data on them. And what we found was, as I think is generally sort of known in the community, very, very high incarceration rates for black males between 20 and 64, about a quarter are either incarcerated or are under the active supervision of the Department of Corrections between the ages of 25 and 34 in 53206, over 40%, about 42%. Again, those are a little bit lower than some of the numbers that are put out, but they're not extraordinarily lower. But again, we can't compare that to other zip codes across the country. But the expectation is that there are going to be a lot of zip codes, and this is a very sad expectation, that are at least at that level or if not higher.
Well, and as a researcher, is you know, the listicle, the ranking an enemy?
Yeah. I mean, it distorts and it creates a sort of a pseudo sort of scientific, you know, this is the worst, this is the second worst. I mean, what you want to know is, you know, what the general rates are of anything, and what does that tell you? What does that measurement tell you about conditions in the neighborhood? So whether, and I think this is a very important point to underscore, whether 53206 is the most incarcerated zip code in the United States or if it's the 250th most incarcerated, it's still a zip code that has much, much too high a level of mass incarceration, and that level of mass incarceration is one of the integral elements of the cumulative disadvantages that we outline in the report. It's a fundamental feature of this ecosystem of disadvantage that creates the inequalities that we document in employment, in earnings, in income, in housing, and the like.
Well, and as an ecosystem, it seems like the message here is that this is not like a chain of dominoes. There's not one domino you can pull out that stops all this stuff from happening.
No, quite the contrary. I mean, you clearly need a comprehensive approach. I mean, this is not a study that was then geared to sort of putting out a list of what policy solutions are out there, certainly over the last three decades that I've been working on these issues in Milwaukee. It's a long time. I've certainly put out, you know, some ideas that I think would make sense. But I think simply studying at this granular level the interaction and the accumulation of all of these disadvantages gives us a sense of what the key factors are, and the fact that you can't just sort of pick one and say, okay, we're going to deal with housing here and that's going to then take care of the employment situation. Or the other way around, saying, you know, it's jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, yes, it is. But creating jobs is not as simple as it appears just by sort of saying the slogan jobs, 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 given the impact of incarceration, given the disinvestment of businesses from the central city. I mean, you can go down the list of various issues. And by saying that these are cumulative, I certainly would hope that someone doesn't say, well, let's just throw up our hands. We can't do anything about it. But it means that we have to obviously have a holistic, comprehensive approach to these issues.
Mark Levine, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Mitch.
Mark Levine is a professor emeritus of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. He's the author of a new study published by the UWM Center for Economic Development. It's called Milwaukee 53206, The Anatomy of Concentrated Disadvantage in an Inner-City Neighborhood, 2000 to 2017. You'll find a link to it from WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now, and then another new study looks at the disparity between home and workplace segregation in U.S. cities, including here in the Milwaukee area. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There are many ways to measure segregation. In the Milwaukee area, we often hear about hyper-segregated schools and neighborhoods. But the impact of segregation can be felt in every part of our lives, including where we work.
Earlier this year, a group of researchers published a report on residential and workplace segregation in the U.S. The research found that while cities throughout the country continue to be segregated, our workplaces are half as segregated.
Matthew Hall is a professor of public policy at Cornell University and the lead author of the report. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about how they created this report.
We were interested in understanding how segregation differs during the day when people are at work and at night when people go home. And in order to do that, we used data from the Census Bureau on commuting patterns for every city in the country, in fact, for every neighborhood in the country. And we compared what the patterns of segregation or the patterns of the distribution of racial groups across cities, how that differed at day and night. And when we did that, we found something that was to us quite startling, that segregation during the day or during the workday was about half as large as it is at nighttime when people go home.
It was surprising how stark the difference was. Now, in most cities throughout the country, was that the case?
Yeah, in fact, it was the case in every city in the country. There's not a single city in the country where residential segregation or nighttime segregation was lower than workplace or daytime segregation.
Wow. So when you look at a city like Milwaukee versus some other cities, how does Milwaukee fare?
So on one level, Milwaukee's not all that unusual. Milwaukee has a level of nighttime segregation that is about twice as large as workplace or daytime segregation. And that's true in the vast majority of cities throughout the country, including those on the West Coast, those in the Great Plains, those in the Deep South. It's all kind of the same general pattern. What makes Milwaukee very unique is that its overall levels of segregation more broadly, both at home and at work, are incredibly high. In fact, in terms of our measure of nighttime segregation, that is the traditional measure of segregation based on where you live, Milwaukee ranks number one, is the most segregated city in the country. And so when you look at workplace segregation, Milwaukee also tends to rank really high. It's in the top five for most measures. So it is exceptional in that case that it has, you know, really high levels of segregation no matter really how you slice it.
When we're talking about workplace segregation in particular, I thought that was interesting because It seems like you look at it in a couple different ways. So, of course, workplace segregation in Milwaukee and other cities is much lower than home segregation. But when it comes to the jobs that people are doing in, you know, those buildings where they're all working, there is a disparity.
That's right. And one interesting thing that we found is that places tend to be less segregated when racial groups are more unequal. Now, that might seem kind of paradoxical, and it confused us for a little while, but what it means is that workplaces, or kind of the work environments, the types of areas where people spend their workday, areas tend to be more racially integrated when you have kind of a clear racial order, with white workers having kind of senior or more privileged positions and minority workers tending to support them. So it is an interesting and a somewhat troubling kind of caveat to this, to our findings about the nature of workplace segregation.
Yeah. Just to take a step back, when we're saying that Milwaukee is the most segregated city in terms of home segregation, where are the rest of the cities?
Well, I'd have to pull the data up.
Okay.
In order to look that up. But, you know, it's generally true that older Rust Belt cities tend to be the most segregated. So Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Louis all tend to be in the top five, if not the top 10. And so, you know, a lot of these old industrial cities that have kind of a common history of both racial migration, in particular of the migration of African Americans from the South to the North, and similar industrial structures and economies all tend to kind of cluster together in those very in that very high range of home segregation. One problem that cities like Milwaukee face is not only that there's an African American population that is quite disadvantaged, but that the white population in places like Milwaukee, but also in Detroit and Chicago and lots of other Rust Belt cities, has been leaving the city for many years. And so the population that's left behind is also quite distinct. That is the white population that's left behind. You know, even if situations for the minority population are not getting any worse, or even if they're improving, if you have this kind of dynamic of slow out-migration of white households and white families, then that will just continue to perpetuate the segregation that's been there and defined the cities for generations.
I know also in your study, you looked at some variables that impact this kind of segregation, and then you looked at immigration status and the presence of military bases, but how do these things really impact segregation in cities?
So there's a number of different factors that tend to weaken segregation. And some of those are some of the institutions that have been very proactive in achieving racial integration. The military probably being the most successful of these. It's something that demographers have documented for many decades, that the United States military has probably been the most successful institution in the country at achieving racial integration. And so when we look at cities that have large military presence, it's not surprising to us that they tend to have significantly lower levels of both home and workplace segregation. And that also is, you know, tends to be true for areas that have large university communities and to some extent have large public sectors. But those are, you know, some common dynamics that we documented in this work.
So to take kind of a turn, what are the implications of this kind of segregation on a city and on its, you know, general area?
Mm-hmm. But I think there's a couple different ways to think about this. And there's reasons for optimism, and there's reasons maybe to be a little bit more cautionary. I guess the optimistic story is that, you know, we tend to focus on the degree of racial separation or racial isolation based on where we live. And, you know, that really misses the fact that in our day-to-day lives, when we're, you know, getting to work or going to the grocery store or getting on the bus or going to church or whatnot, we're actually exposed to a great deal more diversity than those common measures or the common understanding of segregation would have us believe. So, you know, what we're trying to reveal is that actually there's a great deal more exposure to diversity than we might popularly believe, and that's true in pretty much every city in the country. At the same time, it's nevertheless true that residential segregation or home segregation is really stubborn and it's really sticky. And despite the fact that it's declined modestly over the last, you know, 40 or 50 years, it's still quite high. In a place like Milwaukee, it's extremely high, and it hasn't really changed all that much in the last several decades. So, you know, there's both reasons to kind of celebrate the fact that this increased diversity that has defined the American population over the last, 30 years or so, has integrated workplaces, but that it hasn't done the same thing to neighborhoods. And so that's an area where we still need to be looking for solutions.
Yeah. Well, Matt Hall, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Hall is a professor of public policy at Cornell University. He's also lead author of a report on residential and workplace segregation published earlier this year in the Population Research and Policy Review. Hall spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
We'll take another break, and then cellist and contributor Robert Cohen talks about his upcoming stint as a conductor. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Every month, cellist Robert Cohen joins us to talk about the life of a working, touring professional musician. He's talked about concerts and venues, taking an instrument on the road, and teaching a new generation of cellists.
But one thing we haven't spoken with him about is working as a conductor, a role he's about to take on. He talks with Bonnie North about the difference between working with a conductor and working as a conductor.
Well, it's completely different. But I have to start by saying that, you know, I have such enormous respect for conductors and what they do. And I know people are saying, well, they're not making any sound, you know, they're just waving their arms around. And what do they really do? But having worked with so many conductors throughout my life, I really understand how complex it is and what an enormous task it is. And even just preparing the music for yourself and to work with the orchestra is, you know, it's highly complicated. And I think that when people do it well, it's an amazing job. And I would never say, oh, well, you know, they're just waving their stick around and that sort of thing.
Well, a conductor needs to, first of all, understand the piece that he or she is conducting as a whole, all of it, all of its nuances. And then you have to work with the orchestra that you have to make them the best they can be.
That's right. And I think for me, the fundamental difference between playing my cello and conducting an orchestra is that, you know, I'm making my own sound. I work with that sound every day. I mold it and I prepare the music in that way. And when I'm not making my own sound, it's about how I can get other people and hopefully inspire the orchestra members to play with a sound that unites them and that brings a kind of force of beauty and of creation. And it's a very different feeling preparing yourself for that, because first of all, yes, you have to know the score, you have to know every part in the orchestra so well, so not just your line, but what the violins are doing, what the oboes are doing, what everybody's doing. You have to have intimate knowledge of what they have to do and how it's going to fit together, as well as your interpretation of the music, because you have to have a really good plan about how you would like it to go, because otherwise you've got all these members of the orchestra feeling different things from the music and somebody at the front not really leading them through a specific path. So your job is definitely to have a concept, to have a real understanding and an interpretation of the music, which you can say to all those members in front of you, please follow me. I will try to convince you that this is a good idea. And I think that that sometimes is very difficult when you've got 70 people in front of you.
Who have all probably, when you combine the amount of time they have all played, you know, it's hundreds of years, and they've probably played this piece, you know, 20 times before, whatever it happens to be, and they all have their own ideas about how it should go.
That's right. I mean, one of the pieces that I'm conducting is the most incredible Mozart Symphony No. 41, his last symphony, the Jupiter Symphony, which is, you know, perhaps one of the greatest pieces of music in existence. And so the challenge to do that, and the thing is, the orchestra, they've played it many times. So here I come in front of them and say, how would you like my idea of it now? And of course, I have to be completely honest with myself that I would like it in a certain way. And at the same time, of course, one is responding to what is happening around you, because orchestras have their way of doing things too. And you have to mold that into a single idea, which is your idea. Of course, they expect that. They're expecting you to say, ladies and gentlemen, please, will you follow my interpretation, rather than them split into, you know, factions around the place. So it's kind of a dictatorship. There's no question about that. But one has to, well, my approach is a lot to do with how to enable them to enjoy making music together as a group, and also to notice this incredible subtleties and beauty of the music, and to enjoy their instruments as well, because I think they're very aware that I'm a cellist and that I get great satisfaction from playing the cello. And I like them to feel that they can get that sort of level of satisfaction when they play. And I think sometimes that people in an orchestra, they're working day in, day out. You know, they have so many different conductors come in front of them. They have the same repertoire. And they sometimes can kind of feel, oh, here we go again. You know, I'm just playing my violin and we've got to just get through this. And I feel that my role as a conductor is not to say, look, I am Herbert von Karajan, or, you know, Riccardo Muti, or here I am, this great conductor. I don't feel that I can say that to them, because, you know, I haven't spent my life conducting solely. So I come with the experience of what it feels like to make music through an instrument. And so they are all doing that too. And I like to feel that I can remind them of that beauty, of that subtlety, and how they can all get something from their own instruments and bring it together in such a way that it should be really thrilling and inspiring. And I feel that's more my role than saying, look, I'm the big maestro and I have the great interpretation.
Yes, particularly for something like the Mozart 41st. I mean, there's just something about it. There's so much in the music itself. And how much fun for you to be able to shape that in any way, shape, or form. To me, that's how I'd be thinking about it. It's like, ooh, I get to kind of put my little stamp on this.
Well, and you know what? Being on the platform with that music around you, I mean, I know it's thrilling to be in the audience, but when you are actually part of the creation of that symphonic sound, it is thrilling. I mean, you know, I could say, to ask myself, what do I get from conducting that I don't get from playing the cello, or vice versa? And it is a totally different experience, because, you know, when you make the sound yourself, I feel personally that it comes from my soul, and I, you know, through me and through the instrument to the audience. And that is a totally different experience to guiding a number of people to produce a sound which almost forces its way through you and past you into the audience behind you. And that sense of excitement and beauty of a large group of people surrounding you, really, and sending these vibrations is so different. And yet, of course, it's the same thrill in a way.
Do you find it different than, say, playing the solo part of a concerto, where the orchestra is like right there with you too, but you're more focused on your own part?
Well, yes, very different. And the other thing is that in this concert, as I quite often do when I conduct an orchestra, I also, part of the concert, also play a concerto with the orchestra, so with my cello. And in a way, that's how I came to conduct in the first place, because I quite often directed the orchestra from the cello in different concertos without a conductor. And then the orchestra people around said, well, would you also like to do the rest of the program? You know, when you're not playing concerto, would you like to conduct us? And that's really how it started many years ago, that I started to be involved in conducting. And in this program that I'm playing, well, we're doing Mozart Symphony, I'm also playing a Haydn concerto and Bloch pieces. And, you know, it's somehow also a huge advantage when you come to the orchestra that they actually hear you play. Because what I do is I always arrange that the first things that we rehearse are the things which I play with them. And that way, a lot of messages get transferred to them about the way I move, the way I breathe, the kind of sounds I make, the kind of articulation, the kind of way that I like to work with the music. And that is all done without any words, really, when they hear me play. So it's kind of enlarged chamber music. And then after we work, say, on a Haydn cello concerto, then we might rehearse the symphony where I'm waving the stick in front of them. So by which time, I've saved myself such a lot of words because they already understand my ideas in music generally and my kind of focus and energy. And that I think it's a huge advantage for me to work as a conductor when I've had that, you know, time with them as a cellist.
Have you ever felt that you would like to be a conductor more, that you would like to do it more full time?
No, simply. I just think I would miss the cello far too much. I just live for playing the cello in front of an audience and making music with colleagues with my cello. And I think the experience of conducting is a fantastic challenge. It's a different way of me experiencing music. And I think that brings a lot to my cello playing and vice versa. But I definitely think that there are people who are literally born to work with the orchestra as conductors. And I work with many of those people who are just absolutely incredibly natural and brilliant at that. And I feel that, you know, my area for that is really with the cello. But the orchestra experience, the conducting experience, is something that I can get a thrill from and a challenge, and it's very exciting. But it's not something that I feel I could dedicate my life to.
It's interesting. I often think of conductors as having the orchestra as their instrument. They're not directly playing anything, but they're, as we've been talking about, help shape this sound that affects an audience and allows us to hear the music. And it's almost like it's one step removed.
Well, you know, what I find really fascinating also is the sound. You talk about the sound that the conductor creates with the orchestra, their sound. I've heard orchestras one day working with one great conductor and giving a concert, and then, you know, 2 days later giving a concert with another great conductor. And that orchestra sounds completely different, like a completely different orchestra. The kind of qualities of the sound, the energy, the even just the sense of brilliance or beauty changes somehow just by the conductor, which is, of course, it's right, but it somehow can be so extreme just because the conductor has a different way with the music and perhaps relationship with the orchestra members as well. I think that's an incredibly important part of how an orchestra sounds, because when the conductor has a warmth and a passion and a sort of encouragement to the orchestra, they can sound wonderful in certain ways. If they're very dictatorial, if they're very kind of, you know, I'm the boss, the orchestra can sound brilliant, but can be quite a different quality. And I again, the personality of the person in front of the orchestra really affects all of those musicians and therefore the musical experience altogether.
Professional cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month to talk about the life of a professional musician in a segment we call On That Note. He spoke with Bonnie North, and you can hear past conversations with him at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then learn how to dress effectively for yet another outbreak of frigid weather. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Winter just refuses to go quietly. This latest cold snap is not quite as arctic as what we experienced at the end of January, but it is very cold, especially for early March. It's yet another day when people are being encouraged to stay inside, if at all possible. But for people in some occupations, like delivery people, EMTs, and police officers, it's often not possible.
For some, like Eric Larson, this is familiar territory. Larson is a Wisconsin native, as well as a polar adventurer, expedition guide, and educator. His work has brought him to the North and South Poles, and part of his work is teaching people how to survive and sustain periods of deep cold. Back during January's polar vortex, Larson told Lake Effect's Joy Powers some of his tips for working outside.
Physically, I don't think you need to be stronger than any other person to be able to withstand severe cold. I think you just need to be smarter and have a positive attitude and understand that you can be comfortable no matter what the conditions are.
So if you're someone who is, you know, pretty uncomfortable with cold just in general, what should you be doing to prepare yourself? What kind of clothing should you be wearing? How many hats? How many pants?
Yeah, I mean, I always say that there's no such thing as cold weather, just not enough layers. And so quite honestly, the biggest thing to prepare is just having enough gear and the appropriate gear. And so I generally tend to dress in layers. And so the colder that it is, the more layers that I put on. Generally next to my skin is a light wicking layer, which helps keep moisture away from my body. And then I add several insulating layers of fleece or down, and then a shell to protect from the wind. And so again, depending on the temperatures, I can either add or subtract those layers.
So you mentioned a wicking layer. What is that for?
Well, quite honestly, the one of the biggest things that I'm always concerned about in extreme cold weather, because I'm generally working very hard, is getting too warm. Your body actually generates a lot of heat, and as soon as you overheat, you sweat. And that sweat next to your skin actually replaces the layer of insulating air that's right next to your body. And so having that wicking layer, that layer next to your skin that can pull moisture away from your body so that that warm air layer stays intact is very important.
That's something my boyfriend works for UPS. He's a UPS driver. And he mentions a lot of the time that he'll start, you know, sweating because he's lifting boxes in and out of these trucks all day. So if you have a layer that can kind of absorb that's a way to avoid that.
Yeah, not only absorb it, but pull it away from your body to the outer layers. And then equally important, I think I really advocate for this idea of thoughtfulness in terms of cold weather. Very easily, you can overheat, as I mentioned. And I think what's very common is that people just assume that they're going to get too hot and then they start sweating. And so I kind of advocate this idea of thoughtfulness, as I mentioned, which is really as you start getting warm, taking layers off or unzipping or putting down your hood or whatever. Jokingly, I kind of call it the polar striptease. And as I'm traveling around in whatever cold weather environment, oftentimes I'm constantly modifying my layers and making adjustments just specifically so that I don't get too warm.
What are the biggest challenges when you've, you know, dressed at the beginning of the day and you're all bundled up? What are the biggest challenges as you work through your day as far as your clothing is concerned?
I think the biggest challenges are just keeping on top of all your systems and not relaxing so that you think you're in control of the situation and the environment. I think the ways in which I've seen most people get into either dangerous situations where they've gotten severe cold injuries or frostbite or potential survival situations is when you kind of relax and think that, oh, I'm just going to be fine or I'll take care of it later. And so this kind of constant diligence to keep on top of all your systems and to keep on top of managing your layers and your body temperature is probably the most important thing that you need to be mindful of throughout the day.
If you have clothing on that is getting water into it, is there anything you can do during the day to kind of fix that, or are you just kind of stuck until you get inside?
Yeah, I mean, you can get your clothes can get wet from both the inside from you overheating and from the outside when you're kind of in snow or wet conditions. And so it is hard at times to potentially dry that gear. That said, wet gear can dry in the cold. There's a process called sublimation where, you know, a solid moves into a gas. And so there have been times, for example, in the Arctic Ocean on the way to the North Pole where we've actually fallen through the ice into the water. And what we do is just keep traveling in the hopes that our clothes will dry out as we travel. That said, I think that diligence in terms of monitoring your own layers and making sure that you're not getting any snow inside your boots or your gloves or things like that is going to just help that process of keeping dry.
Do you have any tips that people, you know, people who do work in the cold or have to be in the cold because it's just cold outside, do you have any tips that people might not think about?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest ways in which people lose heat in the wintertime is through their feet. And so just standing on a cold surface, you lose a lot of heat through conduction. So anything that you can do to insulate your feet from the ground is really important. Part of that might be adding an extra pair of insoles inside your boots. One of the things that you can also do if you're just simply standing in a spot for whatever reason or like ice fishing, you can stand on an insulated pad, like a foam pad, and that will actually help your feet stay warmer as well. That basic adage of putting on your hat, I think, is really important. So insulating your head. Oftentimes I see people that are cold that, you know, have their hood down and their zipper wide open. And so that's one of the first things that I tell them. I also think that, you know, one of the biggest ways to stay warm is just simply moving your body around. Your body generates a lot of heat. So if you are cold, moving around, running in place, doing jumping jacks can have a big impact as well. So there are a lot of subtle things, but, you know, overall, I think that's about it.
Yeah, when you're working with people for these expeditions, people who I'm guessing certainly aren't as experienced as you are with the extreme cold, are there things that tend to come up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic things that come up with everybody are just cold hands, cold feet. I think people are very concerned just about being outside all day. And oftentimes on my expeditions, we're outside in extreme cold, 30, 40, 50 below for, you know, 10 or 12 hours a day. And so I think just being out for that long is very intimidating while trying to manage doing anything with their hands or feet or whatever. And so I think the hands thing is a real big issue. For me, I'm a big advocate of mittens over gloves, although I do use a lot of gloves in occasions as well. So there are a lot of these little tips that I think add to your ability to stay warm.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much information.
No problem. Good luck.
Eric Larson is a polar adventurer, expedition guide, and educator whose work has brought him to the North and South Poles, as well as Mount Everest. He is a Wisconsin native and spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers by Skype from his home in Colorado back in January. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next.